Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Gavin Butts about No Machos or Pop Starves, when the Leeds art experiment went punk. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
This is an incredibly interesting book, and it's one of those, I guess, kind of cultural history books that speaks directly to the moment in which we find ourselves, as well as being a kind of fascinating story as well. And I think the place to start with is perhaps slightly unusually for a book that's, you know, a cultural history that's theoretical, that's also a reflection on art education, it is really to kind of bring you right into the story. And the book really begins with your, I guess, would it be fair to call it kind of obsession with Leeds as a youngster who, you know, wanted to study there, was, you know, really kind of intrigued by the place, and someone who was also active and engaged by the punk scene. So what kind of inspired you to write the book?
I suppose in some ways because that obsession with Leeds continued into my mature years, shall we say. I began to think about Leeds again not long after the then condemned government in 2010 decided to triple university fees in England and Wales overnight, and to divest arts, humanities and social sciences subjects of direct government funding. And this made me think about Leeds, because it made me think about the art college system, the university system that I benefited from in the 1980s. I should say that I didn't go to Leeds to do my undergraduate studies in art, because I applied, but I was turned down, unfortunately, and I ended up going to London to do my undergraduate studies. But I did get there eventually to do my MA in the social history of art, and ultimately my PhD there. But I got to thinking about that historic system of higher education, and the governmental system and the structures of access that underpinned it, because you know, I from a working class background in the Derbyshire East Midlands. And in the 80s, in the mid-80s, I wanted to go to art school to study art. And one of the main reasons I wanted to go, wasn't the only reason, but one of the main reasons I wanted to go is because I was a fan of the late post-punk outfit, the Three Johns. And I knew from reading the New Musical Express and Melody Maker and the like that at least that two of the Johns went to art school in Leeds, the Department of Fine Art at the University of Leeds, and also their tutor, their then tutor, Terry Atkinson, a post-conceptual artist who was on staff at Leeds, was responsible for the artwork on their first LP, Atom Drum Bop. So for me, as a you know, as an A-level student of art in Derbyshire in the mid-80s, the Three Johns represented to me what might be possible at art school beyond doing my kind of still lives of gardening implements and whatnot for my A-level. And so I got to thinking that, you know, what was it about art education that that kind of lent itself to popular music culture in this way? And I just got to thinking about all the other post-punk bands that came out of Leeds art schools a little bit earlier than the Three Johns. So we're talking about, you know, in the immediate aftermath of punk from 1976 onwards, bands of the like Gang of Four, Delta Five, Mekons, Skritti Politti, Soft Cell, Fad Gadget, and many others. I wanted to explore what was it about art college education that that led so many of the people studying to turn their hand to making popular music? And what was it about that that system, which now looked perhaps in danger of being unpicked further by the changes in by the condemned government? You know, were we losing something of the conditions of possibility that gave rise to post-punk culture in the first place? So that's how I, so yeah, the book really did begin very much in the, if you like, the then present. I was thinking about the book very much as a an intellectual history of the present, trying to look back in order to understand the histories that that brought us to where we are now.
You mentioned the art school system, art education, and its sort of interrelationship to music. And I think we'll delve into that in quite a bit of detail a little bit later on. But the other thing that, that you mentioned kind of right at the start is Leeds. And I'm sort of intrigued if you could introduce the listeners to this place, because it wouldn't be, I'm trying to not sound rude about Leeds, but perhaps in the kind of, you know, popular cultural understanding of both, you know, key places in British culture in the end of the 70s into the early 1980s, and also in, you know, the kind of history of punk, Leeds is never kind of at the top. You know, usually there is a focus on London. Sometimes you get discussions of Manchester. Post-punk, you're probably talking about, you know, certain scenes around Liverpool. And yet Leeds, as you show in the book, is really kind of crucially important. So it'd be good to get a sense, a kind of a feel of the place for people who are unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, I mean, that indeed was one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, because I felt like, to some large degree, it had been unjustly overlooked in all of the kind of popular histories of post-punk music that take on board all of those cities that you've just listed, but including, of course, places like Sheffield and Glasgow, and if you want to go internationally, New York and Dusseldorf and the like. So yeah, I wanted to puzzle not only why it was that Leeds might have been overlooked, and I have some you know kind of suggestions as to why that might be so. But to look at what were the specific conditions of possibility in Leeds and how the art college has played a kind of crucial role in that. I did a lot of interviews for this book. So I learned a lot about Leeds in the 70s through the eyes of people who lived it. One of the things, I guess, that I learned quickly, because I encountered it so often, was that Leeds was a fairly sort of grim and unprepossessing place in the 1970s as an urban environment in which to be a student, let's say. Moreover, it was also a pretty violent place. So it was a city that had undergone modernization quite a bit later than some other comparable cities. So the modernization process was still ongoing in the 70s. There were still lots of kind of cleared areas of Leeds which had been bulldozed flat in order to prepare the ground for various sort of modernized urban modernization projects. So for many people that I interviewed, it felt like a slightly strange no place, because it was between the old and the new in many ways. And I think that gave rise to a bit of a kind of mindset at the time. People not necessarily knowing, felt cut off from the past and not necessarily sure where they were going next. I think this mindset was kind of replicated somewhat in the art schools at the time. Leeds art schools had, since the mid-1950s, and we forget this, they had been internationally renowned. Leeds College of Art in particular, from the 1950s through to the 1960s, was one of the key UK art institutions, along with King's College in Newcastle and a few other places, that was seen to be kind of picking up the mantle of the Bauhaus in the early 20th century developing an approach, an experimental approach to art education called basic design, whereby the emphasis was upon the artist as an exploratory figure, as a figure engaged an innovator, as opposed to a figure who was slavishly attached to certain time-honored craft-based skills and forms of art making. The point of an art education was to get students to imagine new possibilities for creative expression, new possibilities which were based in new technologies, for example. So, you know, by the early 1970s, Patrick Heron, a British abstract painter, referred to Leeds as having the most important art college in the UK since the Bauhaus. Now, all of that seems to have gone sour by only a few years later, in 1973-74, when students are starting to arrive who eventually would go on to make music in the various post-punk outfits that I'm interested in. By the time they get there in the mid-70s, this kind of image of Leeds art education as radical or as progressive is already seen to be in decline or on the wane in various kind of ways, even played out. So the narratives that I encountered through my interviews were narratives of disillusionment, which was quite surprising to me, looking back, as I probably was at the time, with the rose-tinted spectacles, you know, to a time when art education and more broadly higher education was still free in England. There were no fees to pay. There was you could you were still able to get a maintenance grant from your local education authority to pay for all your living costs while you're a student. You could claim housing benefit throughout your time as a student. If you were canny about it, you could even claim unemployment benefit during the summer holidays. So, you know, the system of post-war welfareism was still pretty much alive and kicking in the mid-70s. However, the possibilities that it underwrote within the art school system, was seen to be already kind of, I don't know, withering on the vine or something, and students were starting to look elsewhere.
I mean, some of this, I think, comes through with what are effectively kind of inequalities, divides around things like class, race, gender, and various points in the book engage with these. There's also, I think, institutional issues. The University of Leeds in particular seems from the book to be full of tensions that are, you know, in some ways potentially quite a stuffy institution, but on the other hand, doing, you know, kind of genuinely sort of radical and interesting things in terms of its teaching and its art theory, its art history. And these tensions, I guess, are part of the context for how art and music end up kind of intertwining and giving us Mekons, Gang of Four, even, you know, Soft Cell, who you deal with later in the book. That moment you've been describing there, I'm interested in this kind of crucial point where a lot of possibilities are opened up by the impact of punk. And you talk about the very famous Anarchy in the UK tour, which was a gig in Leeds. And I'm fascinated to know what the impact of not just that gig, because it's one of those kind of classic, everybody who was important seemed to be at that gig, but also the kind of the impact of punk on the Leeds scene.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, I mean, the famous gig, of course, is the Sex Pistols gig at the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. That's the one that's become legend in popular music history. That's the one that everybody claims to have been at, from Paul Morley on down. Whereas Leeds seems to have had its very own kind of Sex Pistols scene when, as you say, the Anarchy in the UK tour featuring the Sex Pistols, but also the Clash, Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, and the Damned, when it rocks up in December 1976 and plays Leeds Poly. That, I quickly learnt, was a game changer in its own right for the musical and cultural developments that transpired in Leeds immediately thereafter, and we forget that it was not even a week after the Sex Pistols had appeared with Bill Grundy on TV and swore live on air and become kind of folk devils almost instantaneously overnight in the national media. So the thing that happened was that this gig was the first gig that went ahead as planned in the wake of the Grundy spectacular, because a number of the other gigs at Derby and I think somewhere else, I can't remember, they were cancelled in the wake of the TV appearance. So the Leeds was the first opportunity to see the Sex Pistols live in the wake of their kind of national notoriety. So as you might imagine, that brought a pretty large audience to the Poly to see them. And this was something that avant-garde art in Leeds had been significantly lacking. Members of bands, or kind of later members of bands like Gang of Four and the Mekons, were complaining that when they were making like performance art, only months before the Anarchy gig, that, you know, hardly anybody showed up. And so that seemed to kind of be proof positive that avant-garde art no longer had the kind of relevance that some people might have claimed for it, that, you know, it was not really kind of getting through to people. People weren't feeling motivated to come along and be part of it or to see it. This simply was not the case with punk rock. So in that sense alone, as a kind of popular phenomenon, punk was something that really turned a lot of people on. But these were people who were already steeped in the avant-garde through their education in Leeds art schools. And so I became very interested in how those two things came together. For some of these people that were in that audience, listening to the Sex Pistols and others, and what it kind of inspired them to do thereafter. And I think one of the things it inspired them to do is that, yes, they were variously excited by the attitude of punk, by its kind of fuck you attitude, by its DIY approach to musical production, by its theatrics, by especially John Lydon's onstage theatrics. But one of the things that, generally speaking, the Leeds art students weren't so kind of turned on by was the music itself. As musical form, punk was fairly conservative. It was a kind of retread of a basic sort of rhythm and blues structure, of rock industry as usual in many ways. So I think what happened was that this punk came to, as it were, to meet avant-garde art production in Leeds in 76, with its emphasis on creating the new, a kind of modernist understanding of the importance of innovation and the priority and the value of creating new aesthetic form. And out of that cauldron was born what we now term post-punk culture.
I mean, there's lots of things that we could kind of pick up on there, and the book does this incredible job of talking about, you know, the importance of venues, the kind of influence of particular theories that are coming out of both the poly and the uni. But one of the things that I found refreshing about the book is it's quite honest about, you know, this is not, and you've alluded to this already, this is not some kind of perfect utopian time. And I'm intrigued if we might take these things in turn. What were some of the kind of class issues, class divides that are present in the kind of post-punk scene before we come on to talk about race and gender? Because one of the things I detected, even with the Gang of Four, who are, you know, really kind of central and important, is quite a sniffiness from certain quarters that they might be quite posh. And, you know, on the one hand, like maybe not fit into a particular vision of what it was to be from the lead scene, but also how they shaped their kind of their music and particularly their politics too.
Exactly. I mean, first thing to say is, I guess, that I most certainly wanted to avoid writing any kind of nostalgic account of these years. That would be so kind of easy to do. In some ways, but you know, given what I've said about how kind of desirable that system of higher education looks comparatively to where we are in the neoliberal present, we've not really got time to go into the crisis of the contemporary neoliberal university, but I wanted to look back. And as it were, write an account, warts and all, of the conditions of possibility of which the art departments, the art colleges, were part, because post-punk was birthed as much as a response to the limitations or the perceived limitations of the material conditions of these people who made music together, as it was to, you know, to any sort of valorized understanding of the you know, how important, for example, an art education was. So yes, I thought it was really important to recreate for the reader a sense of the class enmity, really, that was being played out within art school culture, but also beyond it, as the culture spilled out, as it were, into the city, and into post-punk culture, music culture more broadly. And as you say, you know, a lot of the individuals that went on to be in Gang of Four, or I should say to actually found Gang of Four, to found the Mekons, a majority of those people, or you know, I think it's an absolute majority, might not quite, we'd have to do the maths, but a number of them went to Sevenoaks, a public school in Kent, and that was not lost on other people within the Leeds scene, especially students down at the Poly, the Polytechnic, which had more of a working class intake than the university. So for those people who don't know Leeds, you know, the Polytechnic and the university sit pretty much cheek by jowl on either side of the city ring road, on the northern part of the city ring road. And so students would encounter one another, would know one another, especially in places like the Fenton, a pub which is kind of in the middle between the Poly and the university, and is where students used to meet from both institutions. So you've got what I picked up from my interviewing was, as I say, that the class enmity, especially from bands that emanated from the Polytechnic towards those that were coming from the university, because as the music press, as the NME and Sounds and the like began to take an interest in the Leeds scene and more narrowly in Gang of Four and Mekons, other bands that were part of the scene saw that as being, if you like, the typical hierarchy of class being perpetuated, because it was those boys, those public school boys who'd already been, as it were, groomed for success, being garlanded once more, this time by the music press, as they became nationally recognised for their music making. The fear being, of course, that those from the Poly and from more working class backgrounds would be left behind, as it were, once more, and the possibilities of social mobility and of working class expression would remain obscure. So in many different ways, that becomes a kind of central theme of the book. It's about the class constitution of the cultures of an art school education. The fact that there were so many working class students at the Polytechnic at the time, of course, was made possible by the post-war settlement, by the system that was inaugurated by the 1962 Education Act, basically. It was by far a perfect system, but in a sense, I guess what punk made possible was for issues of class to become, I don't know, febrile in that space, and become the very substance of culture making and world making, because a number of polytechnic students felt very aggrieved when they saw, or they thought they saw, members of Gang of Four and Mekons going round and kind of adopting almost like a proletarian masquerade in order to pass themselves off as of the working class, which of course was an important thing to do in the context of punk. Punk was invariably seen as a working class form of subcultural expression.
Where does race and racial inequality fit in here? I think if we observe the sort of historiography of punk and post-punk, I think, you know, that literature has got much better at being attentive to, in some ways, the whiteness of particular moments, but also the importance of telling punk as a kind of multiracial moment in Britain. What's going on in the kind of the Leeds example when it comes to race and racial inequality?
Well, of course, art education was changing at this time, and although there had been always a handful, no more than that, of students of colour within departments of art on fine art courses, they were always in a very significant minority. I mean, this was still the case in the mid-70s. But by the early 80s, things had begun to change in terms of the numbers of students of colour attending art colleges. And so what the book ends really at the point when there are enough students of colour for they themselves to group together to make work, as it turns out, artwork and not a popular music, but artwork that addressed, for example, the problematic whiteness and the Eurocentric bias of the art institution, of the art school, of their tutors, etc. And as I say, that's where the book ends, and that's a project that I'm working on actually now. But in the heart of the book is really the problems that are brought about in the wake of the of Eric Clapton's racist comments at a gig in Birmingham in 1976, I think it was, and also in the wake of the violence at the Notting Hill Carnival in the summer of 76. The National Front is on the rise, you know, across the country. In the late 1970s, just as these the members of these bands are starting to make music, and the politics of popular music culture is the politics of race and resistance to the National Front, resistance to kind of nativist understandings of the working class, to ideas of the inevitable whiteness of the British working class. So Rock Against Racism, a movement that grew out of the left, out of the Socialist Workers' Party, developed various chapters across the country, including in Leeds, and the Rock Against Racism Club is established at the Polytechnic from 1978 onwards, and Gang of Four, Delta Five, and the Mekons become almost house bands at the Rock Against Racism Club, and they appear on typically kind of mixed bills, along with black bands like Leeds' very own Bodicean, one of Leeds' first reggae bands. And I was kind of interested what the relationship was like between the reggae bands on those bills and the white post-punk outfit. So I interviewed Homer Harriot, for example, from Boadicean, and he said that, you know, they were initially quite freaked out by the punks with all the Mohicans and whatnot, and thought they looked a bit scary, but were actually quite relieved to discover that, politically speaking, they were on their side. They were on the side of people of color. They were on the side of Rock Against Racism, and so this kind of white and black bloc, if you want to use a Gramscian term, was very much something that local Leeds bands and art school bands were in the process of kind of building together.
The other thing I'd alluded to in terms of telling the story is where women figure. And again, I think, you know, punks and post-punks kind of historiography is now much more attuned to gender inequalities. And one of the things the book, I think, is really sort of great on is weaving together the story of the impact of feminist theory in both the poly and the uni in terms of what's going on with, I guess, kind of art history in that moment, and right the way through to the way that bands are actually kind of setting themselves up, you know, on stage and how they perform. And Delta Five are one of the examples here. And it'd be interesting if you could sort of introduce that group and also say a bit about that relationship between, I guess, theory and in some ways, you know, kind of on stage practice.
Yeah, I mean, Leeds was a really important place, actually, in the mid to late 70s and into the 80s for feminism. We should remember somewhat darkly, perhaps, that, you know, the late 70s was the time of the reign of Peter Sutcliffe, the so-called Yorkshire Ripper, who attacked and murdered many women in Leeds and across the West Yorkshire region at this time. So the issue of male violence against women and about, if you like, the problems of a society that enabled or even perpetuated violence towards women and discriminatory practices towards women was very much on the political agenda. I mean, the Leeds Revolutionary Feminists were just one kind of separatist wing of feminist activism that was born in the midst of this particular crucible, but also Leeds socialist feminists were really important. So in the midst of all this, yes, women are studying on art degrees at the university and the Polytechnic in Leeds were also fighting their own fight because the studios were dominated by men. Almost all, especially at the Polytechnic, almost all of the staff that were teaching the program were men, and men of a certain generation. They were kind of 1960s-ish. Artists and lecturers, and they carried with them the prejudices of the time, perhaps most notoriously in the figure of Jeff Nuttall, the author of Bomb Culture and a performance artist and trumpet player in his own right. So you know, women were somewhat embattled in this context, but they were also emboldened by not only the emergence, as I've said, of feminism in the city, but the emergence of feminist discourse within the art school, and especially at Leeds University, with the appointment in 1976 of the feminist art historian Griselda Pollock, who was giving lectures to students on BA Fine Art. The lectures would eventually be published in a book, famously in 1981, called Old Mistresses, Women, Art and Ideology, which was published by Griselda Pollock and Razika Parker. So So women were variously emboldened by that, although some women actually were not kind of politically engaged by some of the feminist teachings, and found their feminism elsewhere in different ways. Delta Five was a band that was made up of three women, one from the university, one from the polytechnic, and one from outside, and two working class guys from the West Yorkshire region. And they were very kind of emboldened by the example of Gang of Four and Mekons, but they were also aware that with three women and two men, and with women being the vocalists within the outfit, that they were perceived very differently to the other male bands. They were often perceived to be a kind of quote-unquote woman's band, and to kind of trade in lyrical concerns of you know, the kind of feminist mantra, the personal is political. But they were kind of, the way that they organized themselves was quite interesting, because they're in the music press at the time, or I should say in the music industry, bands were, if a woman was in a band, in a rock band, she was more often than not the bassist. So Delta Five kind of took this on board in a way, and decided to highlight it, to hyperbolize it. And they went, you know, let's have two women bassists, you know, to really kind of explode the stereotype. And this just helped them develop their kind of funky, dancey sound. They were really inspired by Funkadelic, for example, and wanted to create danceable music. But at the same time, they owed a debt to, in some ways, to 1960s kind of all-girl bands, to the call and response structures of the Shangri-Las and bands like that, or even though musically, of course, Delta Five sound very different. They've often been described as punk funk or post-punk funk. But I think it's important to say, given that they were three women and two men, that they weren't interested in some of the more separatist forms of feminism in the city. They were very much a kind of an inclusivist band in terms of their gender political outlook, I suppose. And as far as I'm aware, there weren't really any women-only bands until the early 80s, and I write about some of those in the book as well.
I mean, there's so much more we could talk about. I mean, we've not even sort of touched on Soft Cell, who in some ways are possibly the most, you know, kind of commercially successful, perhaps. Scritti Politti, which the kind of key individual in that band is revered as this, you know, kind of brilliant philosophical lyricist. Now looking back into the kind of pop scene of the mid 1980s, and I really sort of urge the listeners to get the book and to kind of go, you know, much deeper than we've had the time to in this conversation. But I want to come back to something you said earlier about the next project, really. And you know, you'd mentioned kind of casting the story forward by a few years, and I'm intrigued to know whether is this going to be, you know, a new book, or, you know, a sort of maybe a new archival project. What's going to be the kind of follow up to this study of post-punk in Leeds?
There's a few, actually. Obviously, we haven't got time to talk about them all. So I will just give you an indication of two directions of travel that I'm kind of taking out of this project. One is that I've already mentioned, is that I'm going to go wide of Leeds and of West Yorkshire. And I think that the book I'm thinking of at the moment is probably going to be called Learning from Art School, experimental cultures across UK nations and regions, and it will explore the possibilities of regional variation that were made possible by the post-Coldstream system of art education from the early 1960s onwards, to the point when all the remaining independent art colleges and polytechnics become universities in 1992. So that's one project. The second project takes me to a totally different place, to New York, actually, but in a similar time to this book, to New York in the late 60s and through the 1970s, even into the early 80s. And it's a project that is called Rock is Ridiculous. And I'm looking at the queer theatrical underground and so-called ridiculous theatre in the late 60s and early 70s, and the various performers who, if you like, trod the boards on ridiculous stages, and how they made the transition to becoming music artists in the shape of Jane County or David Johansson of the New York Dolls, of Cherry Vanilla, of Patti Smith, of even of Debbie Harry of Blondie, and many others who made the transition from appearing in underground theatrical productions to becoming fully fledged music artists. So that's another crossover project, which is it's similar in some ways to No Machos or Pop Stars, which is a crossover project looking at the relationship between art schools and popular music culture.